Good morning. It's a special pleasure to welcome you to this very special forum today. I'm particularly pleased that the provost of the university, Gene Block, who is an old friend of our speaker, is, you're not that old though, Gene. A longtime friend of our speaker. Gene Block is the provost of the university. It's good to have you here today. Our speaker today is Dr. Kathy Olson, who is Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer of the National Science Foundation. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Chatham College in Pittsburgh, she earned her Ph.D. in neuroscience at the University of California, Irvine. She served as Chief Scientist at NASA and was the administration's Senior Scientific Advisor and principal interface with the national and international scientific community. She also advised the administration on budget issues in scientific programs. Dr. Olson served in the Office of Science and Technology in the Executive Office of the President immediately before she joined the National Science Foundation. She became Deputy Director of the NSF in August 2005. Please welcome Dr. Kathy Olson.
Thank you very much. I have to admit, we are old friends, and I have to use these now. So, good morning, and thank you, George, for the kind introduction. And I want to thank Ed Russell and the Miller Center for hosting me today. I actually have some very fond memories of UVA. And I have to say that the first time I came down here to give a seminar talk on my research when I was a faculty member of State University Stony Brook, my host brought me into a classroom and she left. And I turned to the classroom and I said, yes, and she says, you're supposed to teach us today. Well, today I actually came down to teach a class, but fortunately I've aged and matured. I know I'm giving a seminar. One of the most exciting aspects of the job is being able to talk with creative advocates for science and technology. And I see this visit today as an opportunity to share ideas. Today, the global economy is tightly linked to science, mathematics, and engineering. Every phase of the world's infrastructure, from information technology to transportation, healthcare, energy, and manufacturing, is underpinned in some way by science and engineering. Research is probably one of the most powerful force driving innovation and productivity in America and around the globe. Economic returns to R&D investments are significant and growing. There are many studies quantifying the benefits of R&D investments, and several reports that up to 50% of American innovation resulted from R&D. And indeed, Congressman Vern Ehlers, who has a Ph.D. in physics, found studies quoting ranges from 25 to 400%. It's very hard to qualify, but many believe that at least half of innovation that drives our economy had its roots firmly in the results of fundamental basic research, which we believe is the hidden savings that propel this nation. Wise federal spending on S&T is very good economic policy. Well, driving down from Washington, D.C., I was able to really look at the beautiful land and see the cows. But our economy has vastly changed over the last 200 years. Our society has transitioned from agriculture to manufacturing to knowledge base. Human creativity and knowledge are now the driving forces of economic growth, and the service sector employs about 75% of our population. In each of the past five decades, science and engineering jobs in the U.S. economy grew more rapidly than the overall workforce. You need to add another set of numbers, and you can literally feel the speed and spin of globalization. In 2005, beings produced more transistors and at a lower cost than they did grains of rice. In terms of consumer electronics in the world today, there are 2 billion cell phones and 1.5 billion TV sets. There are more than 820 million personal computers, 60 million iPods, and I actually got one this year, so 60 million and one, and 190 million Game Boys are currently in use from worldwide. And we don't even know about Game Girls. But you know, the changes have really been staggering. And by all accounts, we are designing an even more fast-paced future. I grew up in Oregon, where a mouse was a furry rodent. Windows were panes of glasses that looked into the real world, and we used to go out and pick wild blackberries. Now I enter the virtual world of cyberspace via MS Windows, and I have to admit, I became addicted to my CrackBerry. And I know this is awful, but last week, when I was stuck in traffic, I actually sent my first Black Mary message while driving. We are just beginning of this tectonic global shift that will continue to be fueled by transformative research and a workforce with the necessary skills to translate knowledge into innovation. When we think about traditional science and engineering careers, we think about Dr. Kevin Lee, who is here, who's in the neuroscience department, and Anita Jones, and David Green. We really visualize the traditional chemists, biologists, or computer scientists. The Bureau of Labor Statistics forecasts that employment in strictly defined S&E jobs like these will increase 70% faster than the overall growth rate of all occupations. These jobs will remain significant to our nation's future. But at the same time, jobs not typically classified as science and engineering increasingly require some understanding of science and technology. From 1993 to 2003, the number of S&E degree holders working in jobs not classified as science and engineering grew up by 2 million. The head and deputy of the National Science Foundation is not classified as a science and engineering job. Increasingly, a science place is in the White House. President Carter was an engineer. In the State Department, Colin Powell majored in geology. And on Capitol Hill, Vern Ehlers, Brian Baird, and Rush Holt all have PhDs. And actually, it's interesting, Congressman Holt made sure, actually was a five-time winner on Jeopardy. A science and engineering degree now empowers us as much as law degrees for decades. I know I'm surrounded by a number of lawyers, but people go to law school many times not to practice law. I really think it's very important that people go and get their PhD in science, a master's in engineering, not because they're going to be doing the traditional research, which is important, but because it opens up so many career opportunities, from the head of the bishop at the church in Washington, it's a PhD in oceanography. As I say, many career from patent lawyers, it really does open up career options, which I think is very important. Our future requires that we educate and re-educate a new kind of workforce with a grounding in science and technology. Sandra Day O'Connor put it this way: many American businesses make clear that the skills needed in today's increasingly global marketplace can only be developed through exposure to widely diverse people, cultures, ideas, and viewpoints. The truth is that our country's overall prosperity in the last half century is due in no small measure to Americans' innovative system, a three-way partnership among academia, industry, and government. Last week, I had the opportunity of listening to Senator John Glenn, and he said, what made America from 1776 to the powerhouse today was our investments in education and research. It's no accident that our country's most productive and competitive industries are those that benefited from federal and NSF investments in R&D. These include computers and communications, semiconductors, biotechnology, aerospace, environmental technologies. The management guru Peter Drucker has noted, long-range planning does not deal with future decisions, but with the future of present's decisions. The federal government is an essential actor in making sure that science and technology help us reach our goals. Science and technology brings many benefits outside of the market forces, such as first-class educations, better environmental quality, a strong national defense, and improved health and our improved health and well-being. In areas such as these, strong government R&D investments are essential. Yet despite the recognition that federal research investments are the seed corn for future technology-based innovations, the U.S. government research investments does not match the new global realities. Now, I wanted everyone to see this slide because actually this has been prepared by the Office of Management and Budget to very simply explain how our budget process occurs. Actually, what's very interesting is it does work. I'm not going to spend too much time on that slide. Seriously, however, there are certain eye-openers have occurred that resulted in paramount shifts of federal R&D funding priorities. In several cases, new federal agencies were established. I like to refer to these as aha moments in science policy history as Sputnik moments. That was certainly one of the times our country really stopped in its tracks and took notice of science and technology competition. Actually, the grand tradition of publicly funded research began even earlier during World War II. Wise public officials, most prominently Vandenberg Bush, recognized the largest benefits that publicly funded science could bring to every avenue of domestic need and progress. In response, the National Science Foundation was created in 1950, and investments in the next generation of scientists and engineers was made a priority. In the 1960s, the federal government focused its attention on space research. We all remember that speech. And NASA received a great deal of the federal funding. At this time, our country was deeply involved in the space race with Russia, a race that intensified with Russia's launch of Sputnik. These investments propelled the U.S. on a mission to be the first nation to land a man on Moon, now we might land a woman on Mars, and also herald a new emphasis on developing the science and technology workforce. NASA received an average annual increase of 23% of the federal R&D budget from 1962 to 1968. In the 70s, the Middle East oil crisis and the rising fuel prices led to heavy investment in energy research. We like to say some of my best friends, but if you remember, like I do, actually standing in line every other day to get gas. That was really kind of an eye-opener, and the Department of Energy received 27% of the annual increase from 1973 to 1979 to really address this energy crisis. From 1979 to the mid-1980s, the federal R&D pendulum swung towards defense, including influenced by the Cold War. And the average spending in the Department of Defense and their R&D was around 7%. Those investments later helped fuel the dot-com explosion of the 1990s because they really invested in computer technology and next-generation technology. In the last decade, we have seen the growing importance of health-related R&D, while the budget allocation for general science has grown incrementally in the last 25 years. Over the last several years, we've seen the doubling of the NIH budget. But the new era of globalization calls again for reprioritization of federal investments. Many global indicators collectively serve as a clarion call for renewed investments in fundamental science and engineering, research, and education. For the first time in recent memory, the U.S. trade balance for both high technology industries and high tech goods has turned negative. Patents, patent citations, and graduation rates in foreign countries are other key indicators of increasing global competition. Europe and Asia has made especially rapid strides in the graduation of new natural science and engineering students and are at the bulk of natural science and engineering doctorates. We know that the research and development and the S&E labor markets will continue to grow as countries seek competitive advantage. Broad expansion of science and technology capabilities is underway in many countries, especially emerging economies, that is both policy and market driven. R&D expenditures are increasing robustly around the world, driven by governments and industry. High-wage nations in Asia and Europe have invested heavily in S&T. South Korea and Taiwan have recently advanced their technical capacity, increasingly challenging U.S. prominence in many markets, product markets. China has rapidly become one of the world's largest R&D performing countries behind the U.S. and Japan.
As you can see in this slide, it's 12% now. The Economist magazine states, as emerging economies become more integrated into the global economy and their incomes catch up with rich countries, they provide the biggest boost to the world's economy since the Industrial Revolution. And it's likely to be the biggest stimulus in history because the Industrial Revolution fully involved only about one-third of the world's population. Hence, the administration took the American Competitiveness Initiative, introduced the American Competitiveness Initiative, or ACI. The ACI sets a bold challenge, calling for an expanded federal investment to drive innovation and sharpen the nation's competitive edge and maintain the U.S. position at the forefront in discovery, learning, and innovation. As part of the ACI, the NSF budget is on track to double over the next 10 years. NSF received an 8.7% boost in its total budget request to $6.4 billion in 2008 and a similar boost in 2007. And this is at the same time where other agencies are staying flat because the investments now are coming in terms of the fundamental basic research and technology. The ACI also increases our principal sources of federal support for physical sciences and engineering. In addition, it focuses on the need for teacher training and better math and science education. This is another where NSF is a leader. Education of the next generation is core to our mission, and the integration of research and education is central in everything that we do. The administration has clearly demonstrated its commitment by investing in science and engineering to increase our nation's capacity to innovate, compete, and grow our economy. Members of Congress and important stakeholder communities, including industrial leaders, are equally supportive of such investments. In fact, there are a number of bills currently pending that would promote U.S. competitiveness through the support of basic research. All of these activities collectively voice the need to renew our federal investments in fundamental science, mathematics, and engineering. So now enter the National Science Foundation. For over 50 years, NSF has been a steward of the nation's discovery and innovation process. The agency has been crucial to Americans' economic strength, global competitiveness, national security, and quality of life. What would we do without Google? Well, Google was basically supported at the National Science Foundation and started by two graduate students. The NSF mission is to look towards the frontier to identify the most transformative and promising research and education directions. As I've already mentioned, our mandate also calls for us to help in a robust science and technology workforce. We're committed to developing programs to recruit and retain students in science, engineering, and math. NSF is a unique federal organization. Other federal agencies have mandates in specific areas, from energy to health to space to agriculture. We're the only agency with the mandate to support fundamental frontier research and education across all scientific disciplines and engineering fields. Building on a decade's of fundamental research, investigators are creating modes of increasingly complex systems across multiple disciplines and scales. Since I'm at UVA, I want to highlight some of the UVA research, which is very, very rich. Jill Vitton was supported by an NSF career grant. And a career grant is a grant given at the very beginning of the career to integrate research and education. And she is actually using carbon nanotubes modified by microelectronics to understand neurotransmission. Another UVA career awardee, David Green, is studying polymer nanocomposites. Researchers at the Virginia Coast Reserve LTER is supported by NSF, are working to understand how long-term environmental change and short-term disturbances control the dynamic nature of barrier landscapes. We also support science and technology centers. And in fact, how I know Dr. Block is he was one of the first PIs to earn a Science and Technology Center at the National Science Foundation in biological timing. And I will say that it really revolutionized that field in terms of understanding the molecular basis. But I have to stop and tell a little story. Because, you know, NSF, we integrate research and education. And I had the opportunity to spend a month at FEI. And as you know, it's not a front for the CIA. It's really training the next executives in the federal government. And so we had the gift of time, and so I came over to visit Dr. Block. And I walked into the Center for Biological Timing, and I had shorts on and a baseball hat. And I said, is Dr. Block available? And the woman looked at me, and she says, I'm sorry, we've filled all of the summer positions. And I said, oh, well, I'm Dr. Kathy Olson. And she kind of went like this. And I says, and just tell Dr. Block that obviously he needs more students working in his laboratory. So, and since we devote the integration of research and education, with that compliment, he did get a couple extra research enrichments for undergraduates. But I want to say that it's the work of researchers like Gene Block and Kevin Lee that really help NSF identify key areas that show promise. NSF welcomes the expertise and input from researchers and educators in our program planning. We take what we like to call a bottoms-up approach, our grassroots. We rely upon the community to give us insights about what works, how the national science and engineering enterprise is changing, and where we are to focus. So we, Dr. Bement and I, don't really set the policy. We hear from the science so we know what kind of questions really need to be addressed. And one of the best ways to actually be part of the government is to spend time at the National Science Foundation. And there have been a number of UVIA professors, like Otto Friesman, that has done that. But we are the eyes and ears in the field, and you inform us as what's really happening on the frontier. Our multidisciplinary and cross-directed initiatives ensure that fundamental goals such as education and broadening participation are part of the NSF program and projects. In order to compete in the 21st century, the U.S. will need participation of every citizen. Broadening the opportunities to participate will automatically broaden the contributions that result. NSF recognizes that we need a workforce to prosper as a nation, and our goal is to make an all-inclusive as possible. This is a perfect time for sort of a brief commercial, but NSF's newly strategic plan captures our new investment priorities and our values and our leadership. And I actually brought some with me because we're good bureaucrats. And that's how you know that we're from Washington. But it actually talks about our values and what we do. NSF also has unique approaches to stimulate innovation, like small grants for exploratory research or sugars. And William Keane here has a sugar grant for examining one component of a larger investigation of how sea salt aerosol influence atmospheric chemistry and climate. We have materials research science centers, and we have new ways of training. And in fact, UVA received $16.5 million of NSF support for 126 projects in 2006. And independent of NIH, I think we're the primary supporter here. NSF also accounts for 4% of total federal funding for research and development. But it's actually 45% of the federal support to academic institutions for non-medical basic research. For over two decades, NSF's been a principal source of federal support for basic research, colleges and universities in areas of computer science, mathematics, physical sciences, social sciences, environmental, life science, especially in the ecosystems, and we support people at UVA in all of those activities. But NSF does not directly support medical research, except for bioengineering, but our investments undergird the medical sciences and related industries, leading to advances in diagnosis, regenerative medicine, drug delivery, and the design and processes of pharmaceuticals. And I take a note, we have these things called small grants for exploratory research, and it really capitalizes on creative ideas that probably wouldn't get funded. And Kevin Lee, who is a professor here, actually was working on some mice. And he noticed that in the mice, it turns out that they seem to have two cortexes instead of one. And he thought this was very unusual, but he didn't know, is this true? Was it genetic? So he actually called the National Science Foundation and received a sugar grant, a small grant for exploratory research. Five pages, doesn't go out for review. We call them sugars because they're sweet. But out of that, even though it was fundamental basic research, he identified a Tisch phenotype, which is characterized by a set of bilateral heterotopia at the base of the neocortex, which resembles the human malfunction of a double cortex. And what does this mean? It turns out in epilepsy, one of the underlying pendings of epilepsy is this double cortex. And that mouse model that he didn't have any idea until he got that funding there to explore actually serves as a model system. And he's now working on major breakthroughs in epilepsy through support from the National Institutes of Health. So NSF is a small agency, but we really have a big mission because we need to take that funnel research and move it on. So what about innovations resulting from U.S. federal funding? Basically, I list some of these up there. Fundamental research that you didn't know what would be developed came into the internet, bar browser. What would we do at the supermarket if we didn't have our barcodes? MRI, speech recognition. I'm going to talk a moment about diversity as well. When speech recognition was first done, it was an all-male team. And what was interesting is that the machines couldn't recognize a female's voice. Maybe mine, because it's pretty low and carries, but it was interesting in terms of, again, the importance of diversity on our teams as well. But the best proof of success of NSF is the repeated replication of its model for discovery, education, and innovation in the nation around the globe. But despite our proven successes, a lack of general knowledge about science and technology may adversely affect the number of young people choosing science and technology careers, the public resistance to miracle cures or get-rich schemes, and the level of government support for research, just to name a few of many issues. Many of the challenges that we face today, climate change and stem cells and whether or not to go to Mars versus others, really you need to have a good understanding of science and technology if you're going to make these policy decisions and participate in the debate. Many people throughout the world can't answer simple science-related questions, nor they have an understanding of the scientific process. There was a true and false question that they asked people in Europe, the United States, and Canada. I'd like to use the other countries because we're not alone. And they said, true or false? Okay. Ordinary tomatoes do not contain genes, while genetically engineered tomatoes do. Most people said true. And then we start talking about biotechnology and food and that. And when you have that, so NSF is part of trying to get science literacy out the door, and that's also one of our missions as well. At the same time that people may not understand science or appreciate science, most Americans do recognize and appreciate the value of science and engineer research to our larger society. Since 2002, most people have expressed confidence in the leadership of the scientific community than in any other profession except the military. Scientists share with doctors the top spot in the Harris poll of occupations of having the most prestige. In fact, I have one slide that they didn't want me to use, so I will do it, where scientists are more respected than used car salesmen. So I do like that. But hence, it's our responsibility to use our credibility in order to create a broad and vibrant pathway for the scientific literacy for all. As the leaders in the community, we must not only lead science to the frontier, but we must also lead the public in its understanding of science and engineering. The process of innovation and education is never ending. Arthur C. Clarke captured it best when he said, "The only way to discover the limits of the possible is to go beyond them into the impossible." What's interesting about this slide is not what you see, it's what you don't see. And that's the questions that we're asking today. If we're going to maintain our global preeminence in global science and technology, we must be careful stewards of the scientific enterprise. The ACI, investing today in Americans' future competitiveness, will guide us in implementing necessary solutions to propel people and education and research. And here at UVA and at universities across the country, these seeds of the future are being planted and are started to grow. Thank you very much.
If everybody will pull out a pencil, the true-false questionnaire will be...
Actually, that one on radiation, I was a little... I was a little sitting there going, is humans called the radiation? So some of them are kind of tricky.
I will move to the back of the room, and I would invite those who have questions to join me in the back corner of the room. We have got about 20 or 25 minutes for questions, so please don't be bashful about posing a good, tough question to Dr. Olson. As I move to the back of the room, Dr. Olson, I'd like to ask what may be an obvious question coming from someone who works, studies public policy. But that is, I think most people believe that science should have a prominent role in public policy debates and should influence public policy. But what makes many people queasy is when politics starts to influence scientific debates. In Virginia, we've seen the state support for the study of eugenics in the 1920s used to support notions of to provide a scientific basis for Jim Crow racism. More recently, across the country, we've heard stories about political interference in scientific reports, particularly in the areas of global climate change, and I think many of us are very concerned about the creation of firewalls to keep political influence out of scientific inquiry and scientific development. What are you all doing to ensure that science maintains its integrity?
Actually, that's a very good question. First of all, as you know, policy has a number of issues. And you have economic issues. You might have political issues, as you said. But it has to be based on sound science. I hate the word sound science because I think all science is sound. But you really have to have a very strong scientific basis to play in that policy arena. What's interesting is in one of the information that NSF asks people in terms of public literacy is, you know, your appreciation of science, but they don't understand the scientific process. And science actually works by hypothesis testing. And so that we actually have a question that we address, and then the science addresses, provides information, and your hypothesis then will change based on that data. So that's the scientific process. So a lot of people don't understand why there's debate in science, why it's not cut and dry. And it's because it's the way that the process is done. And global climate change is an interesting example. Now, we all know that we are in global warming, and that we are going to be continuing to warm until the fresh water mixes with the salt water and changes the North Atlantic oscillation and then tricks your cold. But what's debatable is what's the influence on humans on that. And so it's an interesting as scientists because we sit there and we go, we know we're in global warming, we must do something. Let's kind of move on for that political debate and look at ways of changing in technology, et cetera. But we're always going to get more and more data, and we're going to refine our hypothesis and that the way that we address the situation. And that's something that's very difficult to believe because scientists can't get up there and say, this is truth, okay? This is fact. Because it's fact, but it's on a bigger hypothesis that will constantly change when new facts come in. And so that's kind of, as I say, the hard part that plays. But scientists have to be part of this debate, and that's why I'm excited that there are now congressmen that have PhDs in physics and psychology and medical doctors and veterinarian doctors, because I think it's very critical that they understand that process and know how that it works. Scientists also have to be in that room in terms of discussion and be open in terms of presenting the data where we know and where we don't know.
The first question, Dr. Olson, comes from Aaron McElroy, a University of Virginia student with whom you have a special bond.
My name is Aaron McElroy. I am a third-year systems engineering student, and last summer I had the opportunity to intern with Dr. Olson at NSF. And, you know, through the policy internship program, I worked on issues in science policy that the NSF faced, and I also had the opportunity opportunity to interact with members of Congress and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So my question for you, you commented on the role that people with a science and engineering background can play in public policy, but I was wondering if you could talk about the steps that you could take, you know, as a student with a technical background to get into policymaking.
Well, first of all, I'm a strong proponent of the PhD. And I believe that students actually should earn their PhD because it trains you to think, it trains you to be hypothesis-driven, and really be very adaptable in terms of your career choices. But the question is once you have the PhD, you have many opportunities, and many young thriving scientists and engineers do not know the opportunities that are before them. They can go to Congress, work on the Hill. They can go to policy shops. Again, getting back to your question, George, in terms of bringing science and scientific process to policies. And I think that in terms of when we are training at our universities, we shouldn't be just training for the career as doing research and teaching, but really have it open so that they can become writers, they become lawyers, and that this is just part of their training, and that science and technology background is there for any of the jobs. Of the Fortune 500 companies, of the top 100, over 50%, but it's 51, but it's still over 50%, of the CEOs majored in science or engineering. Most young people don't know that. And I think that that's something that we need to get across, that this degree is critical for all jobs of America.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As a physician who's spent a number of years in academic medicine, including a stint in the National Institute of Health, I'm aware of the fact that in the field of physics, something like 95 to 98% of all these candidates are foreign candidates. And in this era of global economy, they're now returning to their own countries rather than staying in this country. My question to you is, how do we address this to make sure that we have in the future candidates in physics that will remain in this country to maintain this our economy? Could you comment on what you think about that and what you think we can do about this?
Education, education, education. I think one of the most important points is that our K through 12 system needs to be strong and it needs to be robust in science, math, curriculum. We need to actually recognize that these are important disciplines to study and excel at in terms of school. What you say is very correct. Before, the United States was seen as the Eden, where anyone from all over the world wanted to come here and stay here. But if you saw from the data that I provided, these countries now realize that for their well-being and their economic competitiveness, they need to invest in R&D. And they are strongly recruiting the leaders that are now in the United States that were born in their countries to actually come back there, set up labs, and do it. So we're looking at, we'd like to say, our homegrown, as well as having open policy doors as well to maintain a good flow, because that's part of America as well. But we really need to look at K through 12. We need to look at our teachers to ensure that our science teachers actually have taken courses in science and math. I will tell you, I sort of laugh, I actually hated science in high school. The one thing I knew I was not going to be when I went to college was a scientist. There was the thing over my high school that says, what you are to be, you're now becoming. I go, it's not going to be a scientist. My teachers were not stimulated in high school, but fortunately in college, I liked ice cream, gained a little weight. The only thing that would fit in badminton and tennis was general biology, and I had a professor that I couldn't wait to go. And I knew then I wanted to do science and do research and get my PhD, because it comes down to the people and that. And so it's a critical issue. So we're really trying to invest in teachers. Train teachers. NSF has a program where we take majors, people majoring in science, math, and engineering, And I think UVA actually has the Noyes Scholarship Program. And their junior year, if they want to become teachers, NSF provides them a scholarship for their last 2 years of school and to become a teacher. And then they go into the school systems within the state and teach for 3 to 4 years to pay back for that scholarship. And those are kind of the ways that we're doing, because it's a critical issue if we're going to stay competitive.
In high school, there's a major dropout in women in science and math. Are we doing anything to address that?
The National Science Foundation, as well as the other federal agencies, have a number of programs. It's interesting. I was NASA chief scientist. And when they would ask school children to draw the NASA chief scientist when that individual was going to come, in most cases, they would actually draw a man. Not a very good-looking man either, I would say. And it's interesting, I was talking to a third-grade school. It was a girls' school in Ellis, Ellis School in Pittsburgh. And they asked to draw the chief scientist at NASA. And all but two of the girls drew, and I'd like to say, an attractive woman. And but it was interesting because it's sort of training at a young age to say that girls can be scientists and that this is a good career as well as boys, and also enable them to do the on-hands training, et cetera, because complicated. And usually when we see the dropout is in high school and actually in college. And so we're working on courses in that. You know, in computer science, I'll give you that one. When computer science first started out, women were about 40% of computer science. Today, women are less. When it's lucrative careers and great opportunities, women are less than like 14%, okay, that are majoring in computer science. Some of they say is the games that they play. The games aren't, women don't like to sit down on a machine and kill people, okay? I don't think men do too, but they tend to have those games, right? That's why they say don't ad lib, Kathy. The thing is that, but we're addressing it. We have programs. We have the Sally Ride School. And in fact, last May, the Secretary of Education, along with myself at NSF, Margaret Spelling and I, held a math and girls, a summit for girls in math and science. So we're really emphasizing this area because we need everyone, to get back to your point, we need all Americans to participate because these are the careers of our future.
My name is Ed Russell. I teach in the engineering school here at UVA, and I direct the Science and Technology Policy Internship Program that Aaron McElroy mentioned. I want to first give a public recognition and thank you for your dedication to that link between education and policy. Kathy Olson has mentored our interns not just this past summer, but for 4 years, both in the White House and at NSF, and every summer has taken the time out to meet with the whole intern group as well. And the director has also joined her the last couple of years. So this is, I want to share with this group the very concrete ways in which these very busy people make this personal commitment as well that we appreciate.
Thank you.
Secondly, then I have a question. You have pointed out the central role that science and technology play in the nation's well-being and will play in the 21st century. I know that the agency has devoted a lot of thinking about where to devote its limited, although hopefully growing, resources. Could you tell us more about which aspects of science and engineering the agency thinks are going to be most promising and where it expects to be investing more of its resources in the future?
You know, it's interesting. In the ACI, the American Competitiveness Initiative, there's a push to invest in physical sciences and engineering science. What many of you probably know is they actually, investments in there usually builds the technology or the infrastructure, which really enables some of the breakthroughs like MRI. But science now is really becoming very interdisciplinary. And it's very hard to really almost put you in a stovepipe. I'm a physicist or I'm a biologist and that. And it's really questions oriented. And so we actually look at investments across all the areas of science because we feel that that's important for the challenging questions that that we address. And it's interesting, we just had a workshop on neuroscience. And what we did is we brought in mathematicians, physicists, chemists, biologists, social scientists there. The brain, I'd like to say, has trillions and trillions of neurons and glia cells. How do you make sense of that? Well, math really helps. Computer science really helps. So if you're really going to understand both the astronomy, looking out or looking in, you really need to have all sciences being supported, under the underpinnings as well, because we don't know where that next breakthrough really is going to be. That's the one hard thing about convincing people to invest in basic research. I'd like to say the Hubble, okay, investment in Hubble, the software that they use to detect what they should look at the Hubble has now been put in MRI machines to detect cancerous cells in for breast cancer. Okay, so when we were developing that for the Hubble, how did you know that that was going to be used? But that's what basic research is about. So although we're giving some extra attention to engineering and physics, we like to recognize that it's important in all areas of science to support.
I'm Dr. William Rowe. I recently published a paper in the Journal of British Interplanetary Society showing that moon dust, inhalation of moon dust in the lunar module has the potential of damaging a perfectly normal heart. And I went through the Freedom of Information Act and got information about the Apollo 15 lunar module pilot, Irwin. But I was, because he's deceased. But NASA headquarters denied my ability to get the information about Commander Scott, and because he's still alive. And I wonder if there's some way that NASA or someone that you, that your organization could influence NASA about releasing information that is vital for people of my ability to get information from live astronauts, because it's vitally important.
Yeah. It's interesting. I used to be NASA chief scientist, as it was said, and actually all the astronauts and the retired astronauts actually go down and have their annual physicals, and they're being studied and followed. But where the issue is in terms of the personal versus sort of the public kind of data. And so we have to protect the personal rights of the individual. I will talk to them about, because one of the things that, when I became NASA chief scientist, I was actually shocked when I got the call, because I said, I'd studied sex differences in the brain, and I said, what, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and that's why they thought of me. And it was what, but why they wanted, I was the first biologist ever to serve in this role, because they said that really the future to NASA is biology for several reasons. It's the health and safety of the astronauts. And what you talk about, while they're in space, they lose bone mass, muscle mass, red blood cells increase. They have vestibular issues and problems. And so it's not really the propulsion that's going to prevent us from Mars. It's really going to get people that are alive to land there, especially with the radiation, etc. But also biology is important for our technology. As you're all aware of, nanotechnology, very exciting now. Nanotechnology is really what we want to do is make them like biology, adaptable, evolvable, and evolutionary. Dan Golden, who is the director of NASA, used to say that Mother Nature had all the best patents. But we need to use biology in terms of as we go forward in our innovation. I see Dr. Griffin quite a lot, and so I guarantee you, if you know my personality, I will talk to him about this issue when I get back home.
Dr. Olson, my name is Phil Cooper. I'm a local retired pathologist. I'm reading a novel, just getting near completing a novel, entitled Intuition by Allegra Goodman, that has just gone into paperback. And this novel describes a case of what is probably scientific dishonesty in a laboratory, cancer research laboratory in Boston. This is complete fiction. But the novel basically deals with some of the ethics and issues regarding scientific dishonesty and also government oversight of research. And frankly, I don't know how this book is going to end. I would recommend it to those who are, you might enjoy it.
I think I would.
Could you comment on what mechanisms are in place and what your own thinking is about oversight on accuracy and quality and honesty in the science that you fund, and also the role of Congress in oversight when we keep in mind that the money that we're spending is taxpayers' money?
Actually, I put a point there. You know, it's sort of our mantra. We are the stewards of taxpayers' money, and we take it very, everyone in the federal government actually takes that very seriously. So I do want to add that. You know, it's interesting, when you saw the slide, and the American public really respects scientists. And part of that, I think, is because of the integrity and the quality that they do in terms of their publications. We have a number of processes called merit review. And basically, to get funded at the National Science Foundation, your research has to be reviewed by your peers in terms of the study. If something is sort of strange or unusual, it can be picked up during merit review. The same is also true in terms of publishing scientific papers. It goes through accept and book chapters. It goes through strong peer review oversight of that. Plus, you have your colleagues in the laboratory. There are cases when there is misconduct. I think one of the most profile recently was in Korea. And the National Science Foundation takes this very seriously. We have an inspector general, and she looks at any kind of questions. If someone calls in and says, I think so-and-so might have plagiarized or something like that, we do look at it. We invest it. And most universities, and I imagine UVA, also has programs in ethics in science, in terms of that. It's part of our value system. And so when they're very, very, these things are high profile, but they happen very seldom, but they are then taken very seriously by our colleagues, because if we lose the respect, okay, then I think that it will be very sad for this country and this world. I will tell you that we actually have now an international activity looking at scientific misconduct, plagiarism, and scientific integrity through the OECD countries that I'm involved in terms of looking at this not only just in the United States but across nations. We actually have an opportunity. One of my jobs is to debar people and tell them they can never get federal grants again or not for the 3 or 4 years. And I have to say that this year I have debarred 2 individuals. So we are the stewards of the taxpayer money, and we do take it seriously. But I would tell you, we had 40,000 grants submitted last year to the National Science Foundation. We made over 10,000 awards. And so it's very, very seldom that this actually occurs. But I'm going to read the book.
I am a professor emeritus of law, and my specialty is patent law. I have extensive undergraduate and graduate training in science and mathematics. Your presentation today and the appearance of the provost here today is a serendipitous conflux that I think is exciting. Your presentation about your experience of hating science and then going into biology because of the experience you had with a college professor's competent teaching is most exciting to me for the following reason. Teaching is crucial to the development of scientists. You are the personification of that situation. All politics is local. I therefore want to address the fact that here at UVA, although huge amounts of money are being allocated for bricks and mortar in the biology field, virtually nothing is being provided for the teachers. There is a teacher drain in biology here at UVA. The best teachers are already leaving for other universities, and indeed, biology majors cannot even comfortably have available to them all of the courses they need to satisfy their major. And yet here at UVA, money goes to bricks and mortar, but not to getting more competent biology professors.
Let me remind you that this is sort of like Jeopardy. Statements have to be in the form of a question.
And I have that question. Would you, while you are here, discuss this problem with the provost and discuss with him what NSF might do to help correct this unfortunate situation?
Thank you, George.
You know, it's interesting because facilities, though, are important to get the best and the brightest to come. So a lot of universities, not just UVA, are really investing in the state-of-the-art laboratories as well. But, you know, teaching is very important. And George was talking beforehand. It says, what was your statement? I loved it.
The instructor, not the course,
yes.
Because a good instructor can make even deadly subject matter interesting, as apparently happened for you. And
I find biology very interesting.
A terrible teacher can ruin a great course.
Yeah, teaching, I think, is really, really critical. And it's just an important part of the university's responsibilities. And teachers, though, are required not only to teach, but to do research and do service. And so it's a combination of the three, but it's really what makes UVA great.
You've given a great presentation so far as I'm concerned, because it helped me sort of think about our family and how we relate to that same type of situation. The gentleman who spoke over here a few moments ago from the engineering school was working with the intern program. We have a granddaughter currently out of four grandchildren who are either in engineering or some form of engineering now. Three of those have already graduated, or two of those have graduated from the University of Virginia and in engineering in some form. The third is now a third-year student in engineering at the University of Virginia and a Rodman Scholar and participating in the intern program that this gentleman talked about a little while ago.
Did she get the opportunity to go to our office in Paris?
Now, she worked with the federal, actually the American Federal Association of American Scientists, I believe it's called.
Okay, yes.
And last year she rewrote the government program on Homeland Security.
Oh, she did the
online
website.
She did the Really Ready Now site.
Well, I tell you, Aaron and I went to that site. It was outstanding.
Great, okay.
And made the Washington Post, I will tell you, by saying that this intern actually
did this
in the short period. It was fantastic.
Now, the other two, now she's apropos of your educational situation, she is a graduate of the school system here in Virginia, the public school system, and out of the Godwin School in Richmond, Virginia. And she continues as an excellent student and plans to be in system engineering. The other two, and this is...
Charlie, let me interrupt. We'll take the biographical sketch another occasion, but this needs to be a question.
I'm going to ask this question because it relates to something else. One of the other two grandchildren are currently in France. This will be coming up, George.
Yeah, that's right.
This is in France, a graduate of the private school system in France. But he came to the university, got a degree in engineering and in electrical engineering, and then later got an advanced degree in France from business administration. He is now being supported by France in his internet pursuits. The government is actually giving him a loan to get him onto the internet for the development of the gross national product of France and a prevention of the brain drain from France. This sort of relates to some of the things you're saying. What I'd like to know, is there anything in the United States right now which does the same thing?
I think the Department of Commerce actually has programs in terms of stimulating that type of technology. But, you know, you made a point. We actually have, the National Science Foundation has an office in Paris, an office in Japan, and we just opened up last year an office in China. Because science really is growing globally, and we have to make sure that we are also aware of what's going on in the other countries. And for the first time, one of the UVA interns is going to be spending her summer, I think it's her summer, in the NSF office in Paris. Of course, we both asked to take her, but It's not going to happen. But I also want to point out, just to follow up on your question on engineering in terms of girls or women, there's another one where it's like less than 14% or so, let's say less than 20% of engineers are actual women. And yet women tend to go to professions where that they know that they can actually help. So in terms of medical school now, they're about 50% or over 50%. And engineering is one. This is where we need to get the word out there. And engineering, you really are building things that's helping the well-being of our lives. I actually didn't know what an engineer was. Let me tell you, and I was a scientist until I went to NASA. Okay? So I think that we're remiss, really, in this country, not to, at a very young age, to talk about when they're building the little, the piece of paper with the rubber band and shooting down to see how it flies, that's engineering. And that's part of the process, to get the young kids excited about that, and also to tell girls as well as guys that this is a career that's really going to help society.
My name is Marty Saylor. I'm not sure you have any information on this, but I am aware of a new project that National Science Foundation is undertaking, a lab that is now, there's some competition between Colorado and South Dakota. Yes, right. And I just wondered if you had any information on what would be studied in that deep, deep lab.
Basically, what this is we call it on the horizon. Okay, so it is not a reality at the National Science Foundation. But physicists have actually come together and set up sort of national challenges. And one of them is really understanding neutrinos. And we actually have ice cube down in the Antarctic to study neutrinos. And so what they're proposing is that you would take a deep mind, okay, and then be able to go into that mind and study processes of physics, but also study different kinds of microbes that we might not know exists, and these microbes might then be the next cure for or the next penicillin or whatever. So it's sort of a multi facility for biology, for physics, for geology, and using a deep mind to use that as the infrastructure. As I like to say, it's in the horizons. NSF does not have funding for it, and we don't know if we ever will have funding for it, but they're now trying to conceptualize exactly what your question is. What would it do? How can it advance the fundamental research? What can we learn from it? And try to make a case on why this would be important for the taxpayers' money to invest in.
I think we have time for one last question.
You talked earlier about the important reliance on hypothesis-driven research. And in a number of areas, particularly the biological sciences, I'm noting that there's kind of a new wave of hypothesis-free research. Eric Lander, for example, in the field of proteomics, discusses hypothesis-free research paradigms. And I know this is, I mean, you could apply this to Hubble as well, just looking for what's out there.
Yeah.
How do you see this hypothesis-free paradigm affecting the NSF, and in particular, the ability of scientists to write grants in a hypothesis-free environment?
You know, it's interesting. First of all, as I say, we have the small grant for exploratory research, okay, program, as I say, the sugars, and that's what Dr. Lee got, okay? When he found these mice, it was like, I should ask him, when he found these mice, it's sort of like you're going, hello, I got something unusual here. And so we do have ways at the National Science Foundation to get funded on things that doesn't really make sense. We also at NSF fund fundamental research to the universities and that, but we do fund, as you say, facilities. And for example, we have facilities, NEON is one, where we're going to be setting up observations to detect ecological changes, okay, throughout the United States, okay? That's not hypothesis-driven. That's basically getting data that hopefully then scientists can collect and then use to basically go the next step in terms of what that means. So part of our program, about 26% of our funding, is really instrumentation development, facilities, development in large facilities that then enable ideas coming in. And it's like Doozle. It's not, it's sort of like it could, it may, we don't know, but that facility will allow. So it's sort of a combination of the two. Transformative research is something that we're really focusing on at NSF. And, you know, it's like you can have some crazy ideas and you're a steward of taxpayers' money, but you need to give a little seed money to actually see if some of those things might work, because down the line you can have a better, I was going to say better BlackBerry, where you can actually do it while you're driving. No, we'll never go there. I don't use cell phones while driving, though. But anyway, so you do have the combination of the two. And a lot of times, you know, if you've reviewed grants, they go, oh, it's a fishing expedition. But then someone on the panel would say, but yeah, but if they caught that fish, whoa. And so we do have a balance of that we actually support as well.
We're grateful for Dr. Kathy Olson's talk here today, but also for the humor and integrity that informs her leadership of the scientific community. Thank you.
Thank you.